I'm here with Dennis Kine from Veterans for Peace, and wanted to hear some stories about the early days when Veterans for Peace first started making supply runs here into Algiers. So, Dennis, thanks for being here.
Oh, you bet, man. It's an honor to be here. It's an honor to be back. It's my fourth or fifth trip down here, and so it just keeps getting better and keeps changing. You know, y'all came down from Wisconsin and put this thing together, and this is big because information is the basis of everything we're doing. So what's great work, man. We came down here about a month ago, literally, back when there was still a forced evacuation being called on. And first trip in, we came in with Plenty International, which is a relief organization out of Summertown, Tennessee. And we were boarded right up the street here on Atlantic by the 1st Cavalry. And Ralph McAtee, who was driving the bus at the time, the sergeant from the 1st Cav, said, "Hey, man, where'd you get the bus?" Ralph said, "I got it in Kentucky." And he said, "Well, you know, why is it hot-wired?" And it wasn't hot-wired. You know, a lot of guys use inverters to charge, you know, things now, like cigarette lighters. And this is what it was. It was an inverter. And so he had to pull the little trick because Ralph and Plenty have been doing relief work down in Central America for years. So literally he was, you know, turning his vehicle on and off right here on the corner, right up the street here from Malik's house, saying, "No, this thing isn't hot-wired." And, you know, like for a moment there, I was in the Army for 15 years. I could have thought I was in Baghdad, you know, as an Iraqi being mounted by the 1st Cav. It was like a really horrifying experience. And so, you know, to come back now and the forced evacuation's off, and just today in the Picayune News said Algiers is going to make it, you know. So it's remarkable to keep coming back and seeing it getting better and stronger.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about your impressions of the city in those first days when you came in. You know, what was the scenario like? And, describe the city right after the floods.
Well, right, and as you could tell, Veterans for Peace is, you know, we advocate justice and like that, and really we have a problem with the federal government not being able to get down here and provide people food. You know, there's 76,000 people that were residing in Algiers before Katrina, and there was 3,000 afterwards. You know, when we got here, there was, you know, roughly 3,000 people. That's 73,000 displaced people, and there was no flood here. You know, so, you know, there's some inquiries we have to make, and the inquiry we're making, you know, after I heard from Mary Ratcliffe from the, Hunter Bayview paper out in San Francisco, was what's happening in Algiers that, you know, there's no supplies getting in and people are leaving, you know, continuously. So our impression when we got here was that it was there was a police state going on. People were being forced out, and we fought our way in to an area where there was deceased human beings. Totally garbage and trash everywhere, and there was absolutely no need for it to be like that. You know, nobody was under fire, there was nobody here, you know, packing guns, and it was a pretty peaceful community, you know, all the way through New Orleans. As a matter of fact, we've dropped food off all over the place, and there was really no need for people to be afraid to come down here, which was what the media was pushing out to the world for, you know, the first 5 or 6 days was, can't come, you know, you're going to get hepatitis A, can't come, you're going to get hepatitis B, can't come, you need to get a tetanus shot. So, you know, they're delaying action from just normal human charitable beings that were going to come down here and do work. They were putting blocks on them all over the place, you know, and putting fear in their hearts when there was absolutely no reason to have any down here. So, you know, that was my first impression when I got here, was that they were trying to keep people away and keep them away based on fear. And there was nothing to be afraid of down here. And I mean, it's living proof that you're here and everybody who's come since that there's absolutely no reason to be afraid to come down here and help.
How many trips have you made?
Well, this will be my fourth trip to Algiers here to Malik's house on Atlantic. And I've made trips down into the West Bank. I was down to the Marrero projects. You know, I went down to the Scottsdale projects. I've been all the way through the projects on the West Bank. And noticing that, you know, regular and repeatedly, these FEMA organizations aren't getting there, and there'll be FEMA trucks 3 blocks away. And here, in the places where people are still living and still residing, they're not even getting water. You know, we could pull up in a truck at the Marrero projects, and in, you know, a half hour, the truck is empty. And, you know, they're saying, we haven't seen anybody come around here. No, you know, no food, no water. I was also at the I-59 trailer park, you know, which is, that's on the other side of this, of the causeway. And the I-59 trailer park, man, they were moving FEMA trailers in there, and they weren't getting any FEMA assistance. They were taking over the trailer park. FEMA trailers were moving in, and people who had their roofs blown off were not getting any help. So, you know, the model was happening all over the Deep South here, and, you know, and so this made my fourth trip to Algiers. You know, this is a community project. You know, in these trailer parks and down in the Marrero projects, you know, they don't have the ability of having all of a community, you know, being fostered and focused, and that's what's happening here, and that's a remarkable model that we can use other places too.
How do you think the situation is now? You know, because we came in maybe a little less than a week ago, kind of caught the tail end of some high tension. What's your impression? How have things changed since the days right after the flood?
Well, just briefly, I think you might have had some brief tension because they were spinning right behind Rita probably when you pulled in. So, you know, luckily it was a lot shorter time period, you know, of that tension. And, you know, in order is, you know, back and restore quickly. I think it's a remarkable statement to, you know, what you were saying. You know, this is not solidarity. You know, this is not charity. This is solidarity. I mean, that's exactly what this is. The people that we're working with on the other side of the causeway are from all over the country. They're coming from Seattle, Washington. They're coming from, you know, all the way up in Maine and Vermont. They're coming from all over the country. And being that the Veterans for Peace Project is focused a lot down here in Algiers, and we're going down to the Houma Indian Reservation, you know, that's where a lot of the focus is being put on these communities in a solidarity fashion.
So, you know, the impression that I get about FEMA and aid organizations is that, you know, it was definitely too little, definitely too late, and in many places not at all. Have you heard that story from, you know, from just about everybody? Are there places where any, you know, government organizations or larger NGOs have actually made a difference?
It's a disaster. The whole thing is, the whole model they're using to facilitate, you know, relief work is pathetic. And I read in the Picayune today that it says, you know, the military may take over relief work from here on out. And so we have to, you know, we have to notice that FEMA has got a lot of $100,000 clipboard people around. And we also notice that Red Cross, they have a total outreach process going on in a non-time of crisis. But when there's a time of crisis, they consolidate down to a shelter and they don't do any outreach. It's a pathetic model to reverse your operation in a time of crisis like they do. And so then you look at your second layer of relief, which would be the non-governmental organizations, the relief organizations versus the relief agencies. So the question I have is, why weren't they here before us? You know, what's Veterans for Peace, you know, is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, but why are we here and not relief? And, you know, we came down here with food. But what happened was, after we were here 4 or 5 days and we'd been down to Algiers and met Malik and we'd been out to some other communities, what you started seeing was relief organizations showing up. So the response was that, you know, they realized that some of the groups weren't going to go away, like Plenty International and us and ACT, Get Your ACT On down in the Ninth Ward, and we were here to stay and do this work. So it looks and appears like they just flipped on a switch, and then they allowed the relief organizations to take their positions. So by that weekend, I'm out in Bay St. Louis, and I'm out in Waveland, and I'm looking at relief organizations out in the parking lot with their stuff scattered out like a flea market. That model of relief doesn't work anymore. I mean, half of the population is car has either been wrecked, it's in a ditch, or they didn't drive in the first place. So how are they getting to these parking lots? So you see these relief organizations sitting in parking lots and not doing any outreach again. Same problem Red Cross is having. The model I used when I came down here to work in the community was, we need more street dealers. And that's what we put together. We got trucks driving all over the place, you know, trying to get food to people who aren't getting it. Because that's where that's the lack. The lack is that actual outreach. And so we came down here with the model of outreach, and that's not what they're going to get out of the military if they take over relief. So the model of relief has to be hardcore outreach, even in communities that you're not familiar with.
Yeah, how do you accomplish that? You know, how do you arrive somewhere as a bureaucratic entity without any connections to local people or local, you know, community organizers, and actually accomplish something in, you know, an immediate situation of immediate need? How do you do it?
Well, I just, you know, without being an egomaniac on here, is we did it. This is exactly what happened. Is the community that I'm from in San Francisco, I came down here like the agency would have, just totally unbeknownst. You know, I had a friend in Covington, so that's where I decided, you know, we could start. But when we had to focus on a community, which is what I do, I try to work collaboratively in a, you know, in a community fashion, we did it. We found the community, and we found, you know, the people who are working in a community fashion. And we continue to address the communal, you know, environment. You know, we have to at least focus on, you know, an agency that's got a guy making $100,000 a year, whether or not he creates and fosters community, is still going to make $100,000 a year. You know, it has to be a really sheer altruistic, you know, selfless act to go in and try to make a friend anymore. That's one of the things we lack is people, you know, in kindergarten, they say you can't get out of kindergarten unless you can play nicely with others, right? There's a lot of people that just don't know how to play nicely with others anymore. It's a real simple model of learning how to make friends and come in with goodwill. And that's not what those agencies come with anymore.
I mean, other than the tragedies involved with the mishaps and the shortcomings of the bureaucracies that we kind of all depended upon, I would say the happy stories, or you know, the things that give me a little bit of hope, are all of the people that actually put a human face on it, you know, make a connection between real human beings, solidarity versus charity. And that success story, I think, is, you know, not going to be told. It's real hidden. And it's from, you know, from Alabama, where I started this trip, all the way south to the Gulf Coast and here into New Orleans. The only people that were able to make a difference were the ones who came as human beings, right, rather than an organization. And they were the ones who were on the ground first. They were the ones who saw what needed to be done and made a connection. And you know, in Waveland, here in Algiers, it's people who, you know, in Seventh Ward, Mama D, all kinds of people, like, really just seeing what needed to be done and willing to step up and do it.
Right, and totally, when you talk about what we're doing, our model that we've chosen in a collaborative fashion started with bringing in volunteers from all over the country. You know, we put out a message. Michael Moore helped us out a little bit, and we were able to get a message out, which brought a lot of supplies and donations and people. And so you notice these agencies, when volunteers show up, I'm here to volunteer as a doctor or anything of this nature, they start managing and controlling their behavior instantly. Start telling them where they can and can't go, what they should and should not be afraid of. Our motto was, you're here and you're, you know, not necessarily on your own. We're trying to be, you know, we're trying to block for you like a lineman, or we're trying to, you know, provide access for you and a place to rest and have a community that you can go out daily and foster community yourself. Create roots in a little place that you know doesn't have anything or anything happening from those federal agencies, and be your own person. Like, actually empower people, which doesn't happen much anymore, to go out and put their face on it. You know, I mean, it's great that we're Veterans for Peace. It's great that as an organization we were able to put our name on it. But that's not what happened. What happened is people came from all over the country, you know, and said, I'm here as an individual. You know, what can I do to help? And we were able to facilitate that, which is a remarkable thing in the modern era. You know, given, you know, all the media hijacking and everything that goes on, we were able to foster a non-behavioral managed atmosphere and provide services to people that, you know, they didn't necessarily have to have a string attached to it.
So at this point, people are returning to the city. There's a lot of uncertainties about whether they're going to be able to reoccupy their homes. There's, you know, contamination on all sides. There's a lot of reconstruction and cleanup work that has to be done before whole, you know, families, neighborhoods can begin to do the work of reconnecting and rebuilding. And that is, you know, the same situation from here all across the South. You know, what, you know, in a message now to people in wider communities of the United States, or even farther, you know, what is the outlook for volunteers, and what can people do now? You know, you were part of the first wave that came through and helped with just the life-saving work in the beginning. And now, you know, this is going to take a lot of solidarity work, a lot of people power over many months. What's the next step that you see?
Well, the next step is obviously, you know, putting a commitment to it. You know, like I like to speak in some of my anti-war positions I take, is anybody who spends an hour of their life fighting against this empire and the wars they're creating is you know, somebody I'm going to stand in solidarity with. And that's the same thing here. You know, what's happening down here, and I've said it before, you know, there's a lot of assistance we could be providing down here and could have provided long before Katrina. In my opinion, the door is open. And that's the way they're playing this game. They're playing the game, the door is open, and you can see for sale signs and a lot of things happening, you know, all over the Orleans Parish. And so I'm feeling the same way. If you want to protect culture and you want to maintain community and you want to actually, you know, practice what we're preaching of solidarity, you will be here. This is where you'll be. You won't be anywhere else. There's 300 million Americans, 300 million people living in this country. The fact that, you know, there isn't more people down here is not discouraging. I, you know, I have hope because more are coming every day as we are able to get the message out that it's not unsafe to be here and working in community and working in solidarity. So the next step is just, you know, and it isn't even an all-in step. People are coming here and only working with us for 3 days. They're coming down from Maine, working for 3 days, going back and coming back again. We're getting repeat visitors now. So, you know, what we're looking for is just people who are saying, you know what, I can commit an hour. And I'll bet you, after you give that hour, it turns into like a day, and then it turns into a week, and it turns into a month, and then you realize that if you're human, this is where you should be.
Dennis Kine, here from California with Veterans for Peace. Massive project of, you know, reconnecting communities, providing for the basic needs of people. I mean, I guess this is another whole conversation, but I'm a little nervous about what it means to be so plugged into the aid line. You know, I mean, we may be transporting supplies to these people, but where we're getting them from, you know, there are serious questions in my mind about the autonomy that is, you know, in question here. You know, people are without water if it weren't for Nestle and, you know, the bottled water companies. Like, people are without the supplies that they need to actually make their homes livable again without the supply straight from the centralized production facilities, you know, places like Walmart that have done so much to disable the autonomy of the communities that we're working with. You know, that's a serious question for me in the outlook for the future, not just here in the South, in the Gulf Coast, but, you know, other areas that might be affected in the future as things start to slide with, you know, the supply. So what, you got any final thoughts on that?
Yeah, we always have to check out our source of goods. You know, I mean, quite frankly, you know, it's a paternalistic state they're creating. It's one where, you know, we're going to foster paternalism by you like Nestle because they provided you water in a time of crisis. You know, but I have to go back to where I was, you know, when I came down here and marched in the Martin Luther King Jr. parade in January of 2005. I was here marching in the 8th Ward. And my problem still resides with this. Nestle should have been here long before Katrina was. You know, so if we pay attention to, you know, the chronological and corporate history, they're never here when they should be. They're only here, like, when they get an opportunity, doors are open. You know, I mean, just like McDonald's, that garbage that they sell and that stuff that lays out in the streets in those bags is their advertising model. And that's exactly what's happening. They're taking an opportunity to pretend that they're do-gooders when really if they were do-gooders, they'd have been here before Katrina. And so I don't have any apologies for them, and I think it's criminal what they're doing, and it's basically, you know, hijacking the minds of people that really, you know, I mean, it's happening all over the country with Walmart and their interactions with, you know, the dollar goods. And it doesn't matter where you are in America, it's happening. There's a lot of places that they should be long before there's a crisis, and they're not there, so we can't give them any bones for that. We can't give them any props for that. This is just them basically doing what everybody else does. They see a media event, and they want some, too. Free advertising in their book.
Yeah. So it's up to us to build, you know, connections of solidarity between disparate communities.
Absolutely, and it's very important, you know, because when I talk about hijacking minds, I'm talking about our young people. I'm talking about the same young people that go off into the military thinking that there's something noble about, you know, going off and fighting for the things they go and fight for. It's all about, you know, reaching down a generation. For me being 36, I need to reach down to the 21s. For those in their 20s, reach down to the ones in their, you know, 12s. For those in their 60s, we got to keep reaching down just as much as we reach out. And so, you know, my obligation and my commitment is always reach down at least one generation every time I can. You know, I'm at Malik's house, and there's all kinds of kids running around here. And we have to reach down to them so they know that Nestle isn't here and they're our friend. It's like the, you know, the English showing up with, you know, the blankets with the smallpox on them. You know, we have to be cautious of, you know, what's happening to us all the time because we end up complying to things that we never should have in the first place.
And the rebuilding work continues. Dennis Kine, thank you very much.
Thank you, man. Honored to be here.
Yeah, you've been part of a huge mobilization of work to do what we knew the government couldn't do always, and they failed this time. So I'm grateful to all of the communities that have mobilized, all the millions of people around this continent, around the world, that have, you know, responded to that call and filled the void. And I appreciate all your work.
Right, and the Veterans for Peace thanks your support too.
All right. Thanks, Dennis Kine.